We're glad to see everybody here. Appreciate you making the effort to come out. There's a lot of distractions going on today because they're having their 20th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. So some of the people that come to see us or be with us in years past are going up there. So for those of you that made the effort, we appreciate it. And we hope you enjoy the day, this day of fellowship and remembrance. Ron's sitting in the back. Ron and I almost didn't get here today. We were in a wreck on Friday. And so I'm just glad to be here. Seems like we've had a lot of pain in the last 5 or 6 months. We were in a wreck in December as well. And plus a couple of surgeries. So I'm recuperating from a lot of different things today. Every year we come, we try to remember those that died in the raid that took place back in 93 and those that died 51 days later in the fire at the end of the siege. And every year when we come and have these memorials, we notice that of those that were around 22 years ago, there are less and less of us. In the last few years, we've tried to remember those that have, of the survivors that have died since then, and not just the survivors, but many of our friends, that came to support us, became friends when we were in jail or whatever. They've become family to us as well. So many of those have passed on. One, some of you may have heard this piece of news, but one of the champions of this raid, when I say a champion, somebody that put a lot of effort into researching and making available information and so forth, was Mike McNulty. How many remember Mike McNulty? He made the videos, Rules of Engagement, New Revelation, and the FLARE Project. The last time I talked to Mike, he was working on editing or re-editing. He was going to put out the New Revelation, which was the second video. He was going to add a whole lot more stuff that he'd found out and incorporated into that particular video. Mike McNulty had a heart attack in February. So he's no longer with us, and he'll be missed. Over the years, there's been a lot of friends that were friendly to us, even before the raid, such as Jack Harwell, the sheriff, and later on, Gordon Novell. A lot of you probably remember Gordon Novell. He also has passed away a couple of years ago. And so like I said, each year we get a little thinner unless we get new people, that have only just heard about it and make the effort to come out to investigate what went on and what's going on and so forth. But like I say, the survivors themselves fast becoming extinct. So If you go to the internet, you can find all kinds of tributes to Mike McNulty. This same picture shows up on most of the deals that are put up about him. We've had quite a bit of things going on this year. For one thing, we're here at Mount Carmel. It's been quite a few years since we had a memorial out here. Some people have said, well, if it was out here, they wouldn't come. Others have said, if it isn't out here, they wouldn't come. So it's kind of hard to please everybody. But then even some of those that were happy that it was going to be out here wanted us to have it outside. And they said, well, it's going to be a nice day. And I said, well, we've already arranged for it to be indoors, so kind of deal with it. Bear with it. It's good to have it out in nature. I can remember the first memorial after I got out of jail. It was put on by Dewey Millay and Rita and some of the others that were around at that time. And it was held up near the front gate. And there used to be a stage up there. So the speakers were on a stage. There was tents all along the driveway, if you remember. Different people that had something to share, And so each year I've tried, because after that first year, I was living with Dr. Dewey Millay down in Waco after I got out of jail. And after that first memorial, he said, well, he was handing it over to us to more or less orchestrate for ourselves. He didn't want to be responsible. He'd come, but he wouldn't be responsible for it. So we've kind of taken on that mantle or that job of bringing this to the attention of people, to the remembrance. And even though to some extent it's a sad day, remembering all those that died and friends that have passed away since, it's also a happy occasion because we get to see friends and supporters and that we haven't seen for a whole year. So it's like a family reunion. And I remember Dick Revis. How many remember Dick Revis? Dick Revis made a comment one year. He says, I'm not a church-going man. He says, I only go to church once a year. Excuse me. Said he only went to church on the memorial. Dick is back in Dallas. I sent him a letter. I don't know whether he's going to make it or not. Many of the people that wanted to come today, for one reason or another, are not able to be here. Mary Winborn was coming from Corpus Christi, and at the last minute, I think she had to have some surgery or some kind of treatment, so she put off coming. She wanted to read an article, and she tried to get it to us through email, and we had difficulty getting a copy of it, printing it out, and so forth, so we'll have to negate that. She was going to read that article pertaining to this day in history. We're expecting to have some students or a student from Austin. A group of students came up from Austin a couple of months back. Their class involved the protection of documents and the protection of artifacts from historical situations, you know. And that's what the class was about. And so this group had chosen Mount Carmel to come out and see what we had, what needed to be taken care of. And so they've been in contact with us, and we were hoping that the leader... Oh, you're there. Okay, I'm sorry. My glasses are fogged up. Were you going to have a few words to say about what you're all doing? Okay. You can come up right now. We're going to let Laura, is that right?
Yes.
We're going to let Laura speak about what they're about and what they had in mind for what we're about, or what, you know, what remains of what we used to be. So if you could come up and just say a few words at this time.
Thank you, Clive. Hi, everybody. I'm Laura Ginger, and I am a first semester graduate student at the University of Texas in Austin, School of Information. This is Michael.
Hi. I'm Michael, Michael Rodney, and I'm a second year student at the UT School of Information. My focus is on archives and cultural heritage. Today we are here with our professor, Rebecca Elder, who is an adjunct professor. And as Clive mentioned, the class we're taking, it's called Management of Preservation Programs, and the focus is on preserving documents and artifacts of a historical nature. So what we've been learning to do is not just preservation techniques for making sure these materials last for as long as possible, but also how to bring that about, how to gather resources to make sure that happens and that these artifacts and important documents will be preserved for historical posterity.
So we reached out to Clive and Charles initially because we wanted to work with some groups that maybe don't have the type of access to the resources that traditional institutions generally have available to them, and we really were interested in that process. So our project is twofold. It's a needs assessment report and a budget proposal. We came out here in February and assessed materials in the chapel, some the books over there, and a couple other things here, and we also looked at materials that were in the visitor center up until about 2006, am I right?
2006.
Okay. That are actually at Clive's house now. And that was everything from newspapers and photographs to outreach literature. And we looked at the storage methods that were being used as well as the conditions of the materials. And we generated a needs assessment report, which I have copies actually for you and for Charles today. And that really covers the preservation and storage recommendations. So
in addition to having recommendations for the preservation and storage of these materials, we are also working out a budget assessment for the baseline needs in order to make sure that these materials are stored properly so that they can be preserved from deterioration, from pests or mold. Fortunately, the materials that we looked at were in pretty good condition, and so we just need to make sure that they're housed properly. And copies of the budget will also be distributed to Charles and Clive once we've finished this baseline plan.
So right now we're in the budget proposal phase of this, and we're investigating some funding options that they can pursue in order to maintain the collection until they can establish some long-term material goals. And if anybody is interested in talking to us about our project, feel free to find me or Michael afterwards, and we'll be happy to discuss you. And thank you so much to Clive and Charles for letting us come out and do this.
Thank you.
In our situation, with what happened in 1993, of course, a lot of our artifacts perished in the fire. So after the fire, while most of us were in jail, the government then proceeded to sift through the property and the burn site and so forth. And so whatever articles that survived that, that survived the fire, most of it was carted off by the, you know, law enforcement or state or whatever. The few things that we've been able to salvage over the years, some of it has been stolen, some of it has been donated to various universities and colleges around the country, and some of it we had up at the visitor center up near the front gate up until, like Laura said, up until about 2006, and parts of that display, some of it has been donated, like I said, to various colleges. The model we had that Matt made, what year was that?
99.
Matt made a model of the old building that burned down, and we had it up there at the visitor center for years and years. And eventually, I said to Matt, you know, if you want to take it back, you might as well, because, you know, we had nowhere to display it at the time. So he did, and I believe you donated it to another college?
Texas State University of San Marcos.
San Marcos, okay. A year ago, two years ago, we made an agreement with Helen Marie Taylor. For those of you that came to the memorial that year, remember, we held the memorial at the Helen Marie Taylor Museum. For 20 years, that museum had a display, a whole room dedicated to what happened in 1993. And over the years, because Helen Marie Taylor lives in Virginia and she didn't have a workforce down here to, you might say, maintain it or keep it going on a regular basis, on a continual basis, they have a board of museums here in Waco that they made the choice to confiscate the display. They took it out of the museum and took it over to the newspaper offices where they were creating a historical display of some kind. And so, of course, that infuriated Helen Marie Taylor, for those of you that know her. she was pretty upset. But because we were going to have the memorial at the museum, she had her right-hand man, the guy that, you know, takes care of the property and everything, she had him build a duplicate. She made the whole display over again, and Ron and I were involved in the wording of some of the plaques that were on the wall. We provided pictures and religious literature, you know, tracts and things that were put into the display cases. We did not give her another model. She started to pay an older gentleman that had made models for her before to make a duplicate, and he wasn't in the best of health, and he really didn't do a very good job, and he didn't get it finished. But all of a sudden, Helen Marie Taylor remembered she had another model in a back room somewhere. So that got brought out, and it was actually better than the one that they took out, and it was better than the one this guy was trying to remake. And so that's what's on display over there. And we made arrangements with her caretaker that if anybody that hasn't been to the Helen Marie Taylor Museum that would like to see that display this afternoon, they can go there. We can get a group to go there, and he will open up the museum for us. So that's part of, you know, what we're offering today is an opportunity just for those who care to go or those who haven't seen it before. Other parts of the things that we have had over the years, I promised a set of the court transcripts from our trial, the trial that was held in San Antonio. There's like about 30-something volumes of court transcripts that I had a copy of. I had promised to take them out. We were going to go out to California in December, and it didn't happen. But they were going to be donated to the San Diego University out there. Whether that still happens, Catherine Wessinger tells me that this particular professor is getting ready to retire, so I don't know whether, you know, we need to give them that or whether, you know, we'll save it and use it here. If we can get funding for a proper presentation of the of the materials here, you know, we may end up keeping it and putting it in that. We do need to have a model of some kind. There are models all over the place. People have spent the time to make models of the building that burned down. When we went to trial in San Antonio, they actually had three of them in the courtroom. And the one that our lawyers had, I thought was the best looking one of all of them, but they wouldn't let them use it. They decided to go with the government one, which was just kind of a box, squarish type box, but it came apart. Each floor came off, and you could look into it, sort of thing. So that's what they chose to use in the trial. Another piece of news that has been on the internet lately, and I don't know how many of you have heard it, it's the event that it's talking about is old news. But it's come to light recently because the judge that we had in our trial, or in both of the trials we had, the criminal trial and the civil trial, was Judge Walter Smith Jr., federal judge here in Waco. And I don't know how many of you were around when we were in trial and, you know, saw the shenanigans that went on, the lying and the, you know, not allowing witnesses to testify and all that kind of stuff that went on during our trial. I don't know how many of you remember that, but shortly after that trial, Judge Walter Smith apparently got involved with a person that worked at the courthouse. He met her at the water, cooler. Yeah, thank you. He met her at the water cooler and invited her to come back to his chambers. She just thought it was a friendly gesture, and she kind of ignored it, I guess. And so then he called her up and asked her where the heck she was. She said, "Well, I just, you know, you didn't put a time on it. I just thought, sometime come by and see me," sort of thing. And she said, apparently, he said, "No, I want you in my chambers now." So she went back to his chambers, and he began to molest her, you know, seduce her. She reported the incident, I guess you might say it to the proper authorities. There was a judge involved. There was maybe her superiors in the office she worked in. And nothing was done about it. It was kind of covered up. Walter Smith has a lot of cronies in this area. And so nothing was done about it. But just recently, a lawyer out of Dallas found out about it. Went and interviewed the woman, took a deposition, and they have filed a suit against Judge Walter Smith. Now, whether it'll come to court, you know, whether it'll come to trial, I don't know, because the incident originally took place 18 years ago, and in his defense, they're saying, well, statute of limitations will not allow him to be prosecuted or whatever. But from what I understand, the statute of limitations doesn't apply to certain kinds of crimes. They go on. So anyway, you know, as a result, this woman lost her job. She had to have hospitalization. She, you know, it traumatized her so bad. And so this lawyer, I guess, is trying to get some justice on her behalf. So, like I say, whether it'll continue on or whether they'll somehow cover it over and you know, throw it out as a frivolous lawsuit or whatever, I don't know. But it is making the news on the internet. We we lost another survivor in this past year, 2014. I got a call one night from my daughter in Pennsylvania, who'd had a call from her mother in Idaho, saying that Lois Jones was in Idaho visiting up there, apparently, when she got a call that her mother had had a stroke, Mary Bell. And so, on the strength of that, Ron and I picked up Sheila and went to the hospital and found out which room she was in, and went upstairs and went into the room. Some of her family were there. They were not too happy to see us. They were not very conversant. And so Maribel seemed out of it. Whether she was medicated or not, I'm not sure, but she was laying in the bed. And so I said to the to one of the daughters, I said, we don't want to be a bother. You know, we just wanted to pay our respects, and could you give her a message when she wakes up? The daughter said, do it yourself. You tell her. So I went over to the bed, spoke to her. I didn't get the impression that she was cognizant of what I was saying. She made no response. And so we left. We called Charles, and Charles and Alexa went over there, and they wouldn't let him in the room. The family prevented them from seeing her. A few days later, we found out that she had died. In fact, she died that night, from what I understand. And a message was sent to us through the family. We were not invited to the funeral. They did not want us there. And so Ron and I went anyway. But we stood stood off to one side while they had service. And then when everybody left, we went up to the grave, because the grave diggers were there packing everything up and getting ready to fill the hole in and everything. And the supervisor says, well, you're too late. We've already had the funeral. We said, we know. We saw it. So we just came over to pay our respects. Maribel was one of the survivors that lost quite a few of her family in the fire. Actually, she lost her husband on the first day of the raid, and three children and about six grandchildren in the fire. And so she is passed on now, and you know, like I said, our numbers get less and less each year. It's always hard to deal with loss. A lot of people, you know, are comforted when they go to a funeral or they go to the service in the church or out at the grave, that their loved ones have gone to heaven right away and that, you know, they'll see him again pretty soon, sort of thing. We as Branch Davidians don't believe in that concept. I know it's comforting to a lot of people and a lot of people believe in it. But what we look forward to is a resurrection. And so our hopes go out for seeing our families and our loved ones that died in the fire and those that have died since on that day of resurrection. So that's where our faith is and our hope. When they were burying the bodies in the Pauper Cemetery downtown back in 1994, I guess it was, or 95 maybe, a lady downtown called me and says, if you want to be there, she said, they're out at the cemetery right now burying your people. She said, if you want to be in attendance, you better hurry, because they've started at 6 o'clock this morning. Well, it was raining. It was a dreary day. I called up as many people in this area that I could and told them what was going on. And we made it out to the Pauper Cemetery. When we got out there, there was a big old yellow crime scene tape draped around the trees in the cemetery, way back from where the bodies were being buried. And as fast as they could dig a hole, they were putting a coffin in the grave, and then they'd dig the next hole and put the dirt in on the coffin that had just been put in the hole. And we stood there in the rain probably from maybe 7 till about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. The excuse they used for burying them in a hurry was that the bodies were deteriorating at the medical examiner's office. They were no longer capable of getting any evidence from them. You know, they were just in such bad shape. So they convinced the judge to let him go ahead and dispose of them. It kind of irked us a little bit because every time they came with a hearse, we were kept back. We weren't allowed to go up and talk to them, so we'd kind of go over to the entrance where they were coming in, and as they were coming in or as they were leaving, we'd say, well, which one did you bury now, you know? And they just ignore us. They wouldn't answer our questions. They had all the coffins the same size. They had adult cardboard coffins, basically gray looking, the cheapest ones they could get. They had them all the same size so that we didn't know which ones were children, which ones weren't. The next day, the press wrote up that some of the survivors were at that funeral, but we showed no remorse. We didn't have a service. We didn't have any prayers for them. And that we were, you know, basically cold-hearted people. That's the way it got written up. And, you know, most of us have said since, you know, since we've done our grieving. We still cry, but a lot of times we do it in private. Sometimes I do it on a memorial, but it doesn't mean that we're cold-blooded, you know, or that we didn't care, or that we don't have any relationship with those that went. They are certainly missed. But like I said, we do have a hope, regardless of what happened to them and how they've been treated since, that we'll see them again in the resurrection. I'm going to digress just a little bit so you understand the program for today. Anybody that would like to say anything will be given an opportunity to get up and speak in regards to the event. We plan on reading the names close to 12 o'clock, 12, 12:15, about the time that the fire started, which took most of them. And the plan is, for those of you that got the letter, you of course know that, we plan on going to a restaurant downtown. I had tried to reserve a room at the restaurant a month or so ago and was told that Sundays are very busy. They're always full, you know. And I said, well, if we come a little after the lunch hour rush, you know, when all the churches get out and everything, do you think we could have this room that they have kind of off to one side of the restaurant? So we're too busy to reserve it for you. So she says, of course, if you put down a deposit, we'll reserve it. So I had to put down a deposit on the room, and we're booked in at 2 o'clock. So we need to orchestrate what we do here, when we leave, etc. For those that want to go and have this fellowship meal, you might say, at the restaurant, we need to get there by 2 because there is another party booked after us, quite a bit after, but we don't want it to drag on into the late afternoon for sure. And if we don't show up at 2, they might give it to somebody else, who knows. But we are booked into the Ace restaurant. It's a Chinese buffet. Used to be the old Ryan's, for those of you that are familiar with Ryan's. Turned into A1 at one time, and now it's called Ace. For those that don't like Chinese or can't deal with Chinese, it does have American food as well. They have a salad bar, they have cooked vegetables and chicken or whatever. So if you don't want to eat Chinese, there's other options there. And like I say, it's buffet, you can pick what you like. So we'd like to see you, you know, make the effort to come there, if you will. Gives us a chance to fellowship, you know, people to visit, people they haven't seen for a year and so forth. And so you might be thinking about that, you know. Like I said, in the afternoon, for those who wish from the restaurant, those that want to go to the museum, we'll make arrangements to get a party to the museum and make sure that it's open and so forth. So, you got anything you want to say today? Why not? Like I said, I had hoped originally that Mike McNulty would be here as a speaker. I talked to him just, I guess, the end of last year, and he was telling me about, you know, all of the deals he was doing on this new video or re-editing this video that he'd already made. And so I was hoping to have him as a speaker. Also, Mary Winborn wanted to speak. And so we figured we had a pretty good program going there for a while. But so I'm going to kind of throw it open. Emily, are you going to introduce yourself and tell us why you're here? Come on. You've been twisting my arm for a couple of weeks. I'm twisting yours.
You know, English is not my first language, so
don't worry about it. The accent's cute.
Okay.
Emily and Karen are both from Sweden, and they're working out of New York, but they've been here once before, and they're back again to work on a project.
Yeah, we're kind of harassing Ron and Clive. At least I think that's... It feels like that's what it feels like to you sometimes, right? I think they're kind of tired of us right now, but we're...
They want to film you shaving and all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
You know, making a movie sometimes makes you have to, you know, arrange stuff. So we've made Clive shave for us and stuff like that. But anyways, we're making a documentary, and me and Karin, we are from Sweden. And I guess you can say that the fact that I was 5 years old in 93 and that I come from Sweden says something about how kind of big this is, that it traveled all the way to Sweden and also through generations. And we're thankful that we could be here today and also take part of your history and Clive's history. So we kind of follow him around and make him talk about what happened and what he's been doing since. And yeah, come up to us and ask questions if you have any.
How much you're going to do with the documentary?
What we're going to do? Well, yeah, we're planning on making it for Swedish television, like a Swedish PBS kind of, but we're not like totally opposed to the American market, but we'll see. We're freelancers, so we'll see what comes out of it eventually. But it's gonna be good, I can promise that. Yeah.
Okay. Emily and Karin are not the first Swedes to come over here. The first two that I met was shortly after we got out of jail, or when I got out of jail. The other guys went to prison. But there were two young girls in college over in Sweden that had been writing to some of the guys in prison and made arrangements, went through all the red tape, you know, getting permission, getting visas, all of that stuff, to come and visit the guys. And so one of the guys they wanted to visit after they were sentenced, they went up to a little town just outside of Oklahoma City, which is kind of a, I don't know what you call it, a sorting ground or a facility where federal prisoners go, and then they're shuffled off to various locations across the country. So quite a number of our guys were up there, and so a group of us went up with these girls. We picked them up at the airport. We drove them up to Oklahoma City, and we made the effort to go in and see these guys. Well, all of the survivors that went on that trip managed to get in. They were all okay to go in, but the authorities balked at these two Swedish girls. And so I didn't go in. I was cleared to go in, but I stayed in with them, and we ended up, all of the big shots in the suits and everything from upstairs came down, and we went around and around as to why they couldn't go in and visit these individuals. And they said, well, we don't want you to go in, you don't have permission, etc. And they said, oh, but we did. We had a letter that was sent to Sweden saying that we'd been cleared and everything. And he says, well, we found out you're writing a paper for the school, you know, for a class about your trip, and we don't want it being written about. I argued with the authorities. I says, these girls are going to write a paper. That's what they came for. They spent thousands of dollars for plane tickets and so forth. I said, they're going to write a paper. That's what their job is, you know. I said, the way you're treating them will come across as negative. You know, how American prison system or law enforcement or whatever, how it treats visitors to this country. I said, do you think that's a smart move? I said, why don't you just let them visit? Well, they don't have... I said, they had permission. So they said to the girls, we sent you a letter telling you that you did not have permission. And so the girls said, well, we didn't get it. When did you send it? And they very smugly said, yesterday.
Sure.
You're going to mail it, you know, from Oklahoma City or whatever, all the way to Sweden in time to stop them from getting on a plane and coming over. So anyway, they never got in. They wouldn't let them in. We were scheduled to go to Louisiana, where some of the other guys were being held, to visit one of the guys there. As we came out, after all the visits were over and we were all leaving, one of the girls turned around and took a picture of the prison. And boy, we were surrounded with guards and cars, you know. They wanted to confiscate their camera. You can't take pictures. I said, well, that's kind of ridiculous. You know, I said, I lived out in San Bernardino and just across the highway from where we lived, just like a couple of blocks away, was an Air Force base that had these big jets where the whole front opens up and they drive tanks and trucks and stuff into them. I said, and you got tourists driving up and down that road that runs along the fence in full view of all this Air Force equipment. I said, and they're taking pictures all the time. Nobody stops them. Nobody gets upset. I said, what is so special about a federal prison? Well, we got them to stop taking the camera, but they told us we had to leave. If they saw us taking any more pictures, they'd arrest us. So we made our way back to Dallas, and we were going to go the next day to Louisiana to visit this other guy. We got a phone call saying, don't bother coming to Louisiana. They've already canceled your permission that you had to see this other, you know, one of our people in Louisiana. So one prisoner phoned the other one, you know, and said, we've just stopped them here. You got to stop them over there. You know, we've got to be showing a united front, I guess. So that was the first, not the first Swede I ever met, but, that, you know, since all this happened, it was the first two girls from Sweden that had come over in regards to this event. And we've had a number of letters over the years from Sweden, so it's not quite so unusual. Like Emily said, she was only little when it happened, but the news gets around. I'm sure Charlie can testify that we've had people from all over the world come here all the time. You know, you wonder how they even hear about it sometimes. We even had I think it was a professor at one of the colleges said he went to Russia one time to give a lecture. And the minute he said he was from Waco, they got all excited and wanted to know what happened out at Mount Carmel. Basically, that's all they knew of Waco was this place and what happened. And so the news, whether it's good or bad, gets around. You'd like it to be good because a lot of people that come get the wrong impression. If they listen to law enforcement, if they ask maybe the people downtown, if they ask somebody that gives them a negative slant, they go back thinking that's the gospel truth, that's what happened, and that's all there is to it. And they share that with whoever, you know, with the people from where they come from, which is sad. You'd like the truth to be presented, you know, in every situation, but that's not always possible. A few years ago, and I forget which government agent it was, but there was somebody was being interviewed on TV, and they asked him about Waco, and he said, well, if it hadn't been for the survivors continuing to talk and have memorials and give interviews, this would have all dried up and blown away years ago. You know, they wouldn't still be dealing with it, you might say. So We've tried to do that. We've tried to bring information as to what's going on, what has gone on. And I was kind of upset when I heard that Mike had died, Mike McNulty, because he was all excited about this new information or new stuff that he was going to add to his video that he didn't have back when he originally made it. Said he was going to take some stuff out, I guess, that was repetitious or whatever, but he had a whole lot of stuff to put in. When I heard the news that he died, I sent a card to his family and my phone number and kind of asked them to call me. They haven't done that yet, so after this is over, I hope to make contact with them just to see what the status was of what he was working on, whether it was ever finished, whether it's available or not. And when we find that out, we'll try to let you know. Let's see. You got something to say, Sheila? Stand up and say it. I can't hear you down there. Hey.
I'm just very thankful for all the years when everyone has come. I'm just thankful that for the safety of the people traveling and all a lot of tourists to see everyone here. Know that the father and our family's father. We have a better life to look forward to, like you said, one day the resurrection. Everything better for all of us. Thank you very much.
Like I said when we started, Ron and I didn't, you know, we almost didn't make it this year. We've had two wrecks in 3 months, 4 months. Almost identical wrecks, cars demolished, you know, basically put out of action in December, and again on Friday. And so I'm not paranoid, you know. This guy over here on the wall, Victor Hadoff, he made a statement years ago. He said, if God wants you alive, nobody can kill you. He said, but if God wants you dead, no doctors. No doctors can keep you alive. But like I said, if I was paranoid, I'd think somebody was after me. You know, all of these accidents have not been my fault, not from speeding and not from making a wrong decision or whatever. It's just somebody not paying attention to what they're doing and doing a turn into us. I've picked up on a new term for accidents now. Police call it T-boning. That's when they come at you from the side, you know. And so the one in December, we got turned into, pretty much put my car out of action. I had just got this one I was in on Friday a month ago. So that kind of irks me as much as anything is the fact that I'm back on my 2 feet. Without a vehicle, but things will work out. Hopefully, maybe we can get some money and get another car shortly, or get a loan or something while we're waiting. Insurance companies don't like to put out money in a hurry. They drag their feet. I think it took almost 3 months. 3 months before we got payment on the December wreck.
Yeah, but don't make your payment one time. But don't make your payment.
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't have payment. I paid cash. Right. That's why I ended up with the car I did. I used all the money that we got from the insurance to buy another vehicle, which turned out to be as old as the one I had just got rid of. It was not an upgrade per se, so. We've got to, hopefully we'll get enough to get something a little better or a little bigger or a little more armor plating on it or something next time around. Who else would like to have? Okay, Ron. Ron may take a while to get up here. He's all bruised and banged up like I am. I'm going to start calling him the Purple Man.
Purple Man.
Very, very bruised and a little pain today. Everybody could hear me?
Yeah.
I only want to mention two things that are very important, but they're happening this year. Mike McNulty, having passed, those materials that he wanted to put out to the rest of the world, they might just lie fallow. Nothing might happen. So if anybody knows the people that are producing or have been helping Mike, if you could get in contact with them and let them know how important their work has been to us in the past and will be in the future, that's a very important thing, that Mike's work doesn't die with him. The second important thing is the folks from that came up from UT Austin with the archival references. These people are very important to us and the history that will be known in generations to come. A lot of the folks that we've known you guys for 20 years or so might have walked the grounds and collected artifacts or collected newspapers, magazines, things that are important to you that might need that same archival preservation. So as this thing gets rolling, if and when the money comes in, the funding, if you want your particular package of artifacts to go into posterity, let us know, give us a call, or of course the UT people also, because these things need to be preserved. People these days seem to need evidence, and as the survivors pass on, that evidence disappears, that word of mouth. So we're going to need those articles, those particular pieces that you picked up. Even I know people that picked up buckets and buckets full of bullets and stuff like that. So those things, eventually, if there is an established area on this property for that type of stuff for other people to see, hopefully that'll all come back to us. Of course, keep what you really want, for yourselves. But if you think you have something that might belong to the public in the future, it'd be great to, have it come back for everybody to see. That's all I got to say. But this is a good year because things are happening, and even Judge Smith has got a little bit of his comeuppance, which I'm sure a lot of people are glad about. But thank you.
Speaking of archival artifacts and so forth, for those that are, as Ron invited you to, if you have any and want to donate them or whatever to a display, kind of encourage you to do it fairly soon, because we're all getting old, and like I said, we're dying off year by year. The ones that can verify it or speak to it, quite a number of years ago, I helped a guy write a book. He wrote it. I did some editing and proofreading and stuff for him. But while I was working with him, he said, "Oh, I've got some of David Koresh's original manuscripts." And I said, "Well, that's interesting. I'd like to see them. Do you think I could have a look at them?" "Oh, no. He says, "I found these on the property." And I don't know whether he meant here or up at Palestine or what, because wherever we were at in 1993, all of the places out in California, up at Palestine and this property, were all, you might say, raided besides law enforcement rating is you had all of these people fussing for souvenirs. And so he said, I've got these manuscripts. I found them on the property. And he wouldn't let me see them. And I kept working with him for several more weeks. And finally, I said, how come you won't let me see them? I said, it'd be very interesting to see them. So he comes up with this envelope full of handwritten studies, is what they were, the Bible study type of thing. Yeah, but he finally let me look at them. And I says, this is not David Koresh's handwriting. Well, how do you know? I says, because it's mine. I said, what you've got is what I was working on, or part of what I was working on the day they gassed the building. On April 18th, I'd been sick all day. You know, if you can imagine 50 days of hardly any water, hardly any food, all kinds of noise deprivation and stressful situations going on for all that time. I wasn't sleeping. I would lay awake all night and watch while others slept or tried to sleep. Most people in there were using earplugs to cut out the noise. I didn't have any, and I probably wouldn't have worn them if I did. So by April the 18th, I was pretty much run down. I spent the day in bed, dozing off and on. But so that night I couldn't sleep because I'd been dozing off all day. So I got up and I came down to the chapel, and they had these floodlights on the building. So I was sitting over at one of the windows trying to use the floodlights to read with. I had a tape recorder playing David's tapes, and I was transcribing them in longhand. And I'd been doing it long before that, but that was the last one I tried to do. And so, you know, I told this guy, I says, you don't have any of David's manuscripts. I said, they're my transcriptions of his taped sermons. So he was a little disappointed, but he still didn't give them to me, I don't think, if I remember correctly. And over the years, we've had situations like that where people think they've got something, you know, that's valuable, or that they've got something that's authentic, and when you get to see it, it's not. You know, it's something else. They've convinced themselves they've got the genuine article. So, like I say, if you've got artifacts or whatever, might be good to bring them around when there's still people that can identify that were there. You know, so. Like I say, a lot of stuff, as Ron mentioned, buckets and buckets of bullets that we had. That was after the government took their share of it, you know, more than their share. You know, when they came out and sifted through all the ashes after the fire, they took truckload after truckload of topsoil away. You know, if you try to have a garden out here and it doesn't work too good, it's probably because all the topsoil's been stolen. But even after that, after they'd taken all that stuff, we gathered up lots and lots of bullets. We had buckets and buckets of them at Dewey Malay's house until somebody went into his shed in the backyard and took them all. I guess they were going to sell them on eBay or sell them at the gun shows or whatever, but you know, so they figured that was a windfall for them. So, in the past, I've come across people who thought they had original writings of Victor Hardoff or Ben Roden or whatever, and you find they're not. They're copies and altered copies. They're not the original. They're not. They don't read the same. So. You know, if you think you got anything, it'd be just nice to be able to verify it. Anyone else? Charles, you got anything to say?
I had anything to say.
Well, I know you did. Ophelia?
I may have something to say after this.
Okay. You know, speak into the mic.
Okay. I never been a speaker. I'm always been very shy, but I would like to say something that hasn't been said in 22 years. I'm the last survivor in this living in this property. And I've been evicted from this property by Charles Bates and Tom Conwell. And I think I have a right to be here, and I've been evicted. I love this place. My blood has been shed here in this place. And I lost my daughter and her five kids. And Charles Pace is a self-appointed and a squatter. This property. Okay. I've been living without any water for 4 months.
That's your choice.
And I've been mistreated by him. And I left the church because he's very abusive. He even fights physically in the church, in the service. So I just wanted to say it. I had to get it out of my chest. Thank you for listening. Oh, if you, somebody wants some more information, they can call to my judge. His name is Hendo Henderson, and his phone is 682-225-3333. He can answer any questions about me and my case. Thank you very much.
Hi, everybody. I'm Alexa Pace, Charles Pace's wife, and I'd just like to respond to what was just said. I have been lovingly taking care of Ophelia since, her mother passed on and she lived at the back here. I've been her transportation, and I've helped her with her health issues or whatever it is that she needed, and I have done it gladly. But most recently, Ophelia has decided to follow another Messiah who lives up in Fort Worth, I guess, and it's because of her roommate back there, Simeon LaVille, has moved into her little trailer at the back, uninvited, and has basically taken over her mind and her pocketbook, living off her Social Security, her measly little food stamps that she gets. And because of that, we have asked her to leave the property because she's living in a trailer at the back with somebody else who's not invited here anymore, who has basically brainwashed her to believe in this Hendel Henderson, who is claiming to be the world court judge and the new Messiah, and he has a partner who's called herself Shekinah, and she's the one that owns all the jewels in Buckingham Palace that belong to the Queen. So because of the situation has gotten ridiculously out of hand, that we have asked them to leave, and I think we have a right because we are a community, our church, and Clive Doyle is in agreement with us, so that you all know that we're not doing it opposing to his, what he's believing as well. He's offered to take Ophelia to her family because she's getting elderly and she needs help. But since she doesn't want our help anymore, she's been basically asked to move on where she could be happy and well cared for. Because we do love her and we know she's getting elderly, and I hate to see her being controlled by another man who has no place to live, no pocketbook, nothing, and has basically just moved in on her and controlled her. And it just makes me angry that you've gotten away with this, Simeon. It really makes me angry that you've done this to this poor old lady. So, God have mercy on you is what I have to say to you, okay? God have mercy on you.
Clive, I do have something to say now. Okay. I wasn't going to bring this up unless you brought it up, okay? And you people know who you are. You're not wanted here because you don't believe as Branch Davidians. You do not believe what Branch Davidians believe anymore. You be quiet, you had your say. There's a man, his name is Hendel Henderson. I invited him here to tell us what he was all about. Simeon, who had been living here for 5 years, we've been basically paying for everything because he is an undocumented alien, okay? And he didn't have a pot to piss in, so to speak. And we took him in. Why? Because he said he believed in what we were teaching, what I was teaching here. About what happened with David Koresh, how the eschatology of the branch, you know, was fulfilled, how this was all a prophecy. And he believed this until he got online and he started listening to conference calls that this Hendel Henderson and Shelley Bowling have been putting out every week, you know. And I told him to be very careful because not everything is as they say it is. And God himself will give you a strong delusion to believe a lie. God will do that. He'll give you a strong delusion to believe a lie if you don't have a love for the truth. So I tried to tell these two individuals that if you believed in David Koresh, Ophelia, then you would be keeping communion. Because David Koresh kept communion. Ben Roden, Lois Roden, they all taught communion until Christ comes. But Hendel Henderson told you, no, we don't do that. We shouldn't be doing that. And I disagreed. I disagreed to him right in his face over the phone. So he has it in for me. He told me that David Koresh got slaughtered because he kept communion. Are you kidding me? There's going to be a lot of Christians that are going to be slaughtered, I guess, because they've kept communion in remembrance of what Christ did for them. No, that's not, that's Antichrist. And I'll go to my grave believing that, okay? Because I don't see anywhere in the scriptures where it says that Christ told us to wait until he comes back and then we'll keep communion with him. That's not what he said. He said, do this in remembrance of me. As often as you do it. In other words, do it often. So this is the crux of the matter, okay? Simeon has lied, has had me put in jail. He's bragging to Ron yesterday that he had me in jail for a week. I was in jail for 24 hours
because of a misdemeanor that he lied about. Okay, he told them that the sheriff, that I pointed a gun at him and threatened him and told him not to come on the property anymore. He's been evicted. We gave him a 30-day notice. There were 2 weeks left. There's no way I would jeopardize that. Okay, and I know he is able to get on the property. But he lied. Just like Judas lied, you know, to get rid of Christ, to have him put in jail. And I told you, you have a Judas spirit. You're a betrayer. Yeah, you, Simeon. That guy is sitting right there next to the two black guys there. Liar. Did you tell Ron that I was in jail for a week? Yesterday, when he was in the hospital? I was in there for 24 hours. It was a misdemeanor because you lied. I told them that I showed you the gun, and I told you, while you were standing by our mailbox, okay, you can't be by our mailbox. It's illegal. I told you that when you are evicted and you try to come on the property, you will be a trespasser. And I showed you the gun. I didn't point it at you. I showed it to you. I was sitting in the front seat of the car. And I showed you the gun and I said, I will use this gun on any trespassers. And I have a right by the law to do that.
You can convince these people that.
You be quiet. You're a liar. Well, just let me finish.
The idea is to take the property.
Let me finish, please. Hendo Henderson and Simeon are going to try to take the property. The property. You want it to be, here as a memorial, as a museum, as a historic site? Well, then don't let them take the property. They're even trying to make up stories so that they can get me locked up in jail to get me off the property. And this place wouldn't be here if it wasn't for me and my wife. Somebody else would have taken it over. Doug Mitchell, Amo, anyone else that thought that they can, this is a public place where they can come and just squat. No, you can't do that. This is church property. And whether I am a self-appointed leader of the church or God-appointed leader of the church, I'm still the one that's taking care of this place and paying for it with my own money and from my own pocket. Because nobody gives us any donations. And you see how manicured it is. You see how, well kept it is. That's because of what we've been doing. Okay? So, I'm glad you're here because you're supposed to be here because this is where the memorial should be kept. And I've never told the survivors they couldn't be here. Never said that. I've told others and I've done things so that others wouldn't take it over. And I believe I've been preserving it just like you're talking about, preserving the materials, the newspapers and all that stuff. I'm preserving the property for God's sake. I'm preserving the property for God's sake. Do you understand? And I've been here all these years and nobody's been able to get me off of the property. That should tell you something. And I've asked Clive to move back. He can even have his old house back if he wants. But nobody's going to take this property. No world court judge or wannabe world court judge is going to take it. Because you know who the world court judge is? It's my Lord and Savior. The branch, the Lord, our righteousness. By the way, branch means son or daughter. Branch Davidian means my beloved son and daughter, or my beloved sons and daughters. And that's who we are. We're branch Davidians. We're not Moors. We're not Muslims, which is what Hendo Henderson is. He claims to be believing in Christ, but he doesn't believe in Christ. He thinks he's the Messiah. He's another David Koresh. Okay? But David Koresh did it because God asked him to do it. This guy's doing it because he thinks he is the Messiah. God had a purpose for Vernon to do it, to call, you know, to be David Koresh. And I believe that. I teach that. But this Hendel Henderson, who thinks he's the world court judge, you know what that means? You know what he thinks he is? He thinks that he has jurisdiction over every court in the world. And he is the judge. Right, Simeon? That's what they believe. I can't go along with that. Time out. Okay. Catherine?
May I come and speak?
Sure.
I just wanted to get us back to why we're here, and I appreciate you see how intense this is, and I just want to say, Ophelia, I'm glad to see that you're well. I really am. But I have some information I wanted to share with you about the events on April 19th, 1993, which is why we're here. And, whenever I come out here, I always look at the area where the vault was. And that's, you know, it was a former vault. It was a concrete room. And as Clive has explained, there was no door to the vault. It was an open doorway. And it had survived a previous fire that had destroyed the previous building here. And as Clive has explained to me, with all the contents intact. And so, of course, there was a lot happening here out on the morning of April 19th. The assault by the FBI started at 6 a.m. It was a tank and CS gas assault. CS gas is a tear gas agent, as many of you know, and it's intended for outdoor use only, not indoor use. It was being inserted through sprayers on the nozzles of the booms of the tanks. And the FBI agents were also firing in ferret rounds, which are little rocket-shaped things, and then they hit something like a wall or a piece of furniture or a person. They burst, and the gas is emitted. And so that had been going on that morning since 6 a.m. And at beginning at about 11:35, and we're close to 11:35 now on this morning. And one of the tanks was ordered to drive up to the open door of the vault and gas the small children and their mothers who were huddled in the vault, which was the safest room in the building. And that gassing occurred between 11:35 and about 11:55. Now, later, you know, during congressional testimonies and so forth, and the trials, FBI agents say, well, they really didn't gas the vault. They didn't get close enough to gas it. But that was the order, and that was the intent. And the tank drove through the building and got as close to the vault as it could to emit the gas. So the gassing of the vault, or at least the gassing of the area of the vault, ended about 11:55. And the first fire was seen over here in a second floor window. And that was actually formerly Sheila's room. But of course, Sheila had already come out during the siege. So we're in the last half hour or so of what would have been, you know, the morning of that assault. And so I think now we need to turn our attention to what happened on that day. And thank you very much.
Steve?
I'll just say, because I didn't get to come the last couple of years. I think most of you guys know me. I know Clive does. I did the very first video documentary on what happened here on February 28th. And we've actually made that documentary during the standoff. And it was publicized on Ron Emmons' show to be released on April 19th. basically why they chose the 19th, I don't know. But we had advertised on Lonnie Ullman's show for a couple of weeks prior that that was the day that the first documentary was going to be made about that assault on February 28th. Me and Mike McNulty, which I didn't know he was dead, I'm sorry to hear that, we went round and round. I helped him on his first one extensively. The FLIR thing is pretty much what he concentrated on. He had a lot of stuff that he got from Channel 8 up there in Dallas, a lot of raw footage, and I couldn't believe some of the stuff they gave him. It was very, very interesting footage, and so I hope that the people that survive him, I hope that they preserve that footage, because there's some stuff on there that he totally missed. I'm going to tell you straight away, he totally missed it. The whole thing, you know, it's 22 years, guys. Is it over? I don't know. I don't know yet. There's no statute of limitations on murder, okay? What happened here was murder. There's no way around it. I don't give a darn about the religion, because I'm not religious at all. But you don't do what happened here. I don't care if you're in Sweden or the United States or Australia. It's murder, all right? It won't ever be over for me, all right?
Hi. Got one more to you.
If we want to be fair, I would like Simeon to say a few words.
No, I'm not going to let Simeon talk.
Pardon?
I'm not going to let Simeon talk.
Why?
He knows why.
He's been a member of the church.
He hasn't been a member of this church.
Yes, he has.
Not of the Branch Davidian.
4 years.
He's been here with Charlie for 4 years being taken care of, but he's not been a member of the Branch Davidians.
Doesn't he have a right to defend himself?
I'm sure he's got plenty to say, but I don't want to hear him today. I said I didn't want to hear you today, Simeon.
Thank you. I was born Billy Stephen Kreider. People know me by Steve. They know me by Billy Kreider. They know me as Steve Kreider. Some people know me by Stephen Benjamin. Some people know me as Benjamin. I've been coming out here since 1999. I've been living here since 2011. The world's watching right now. All of us. They're watching you. They're watching you. They're watching you. They're watching you. They're watching me. Documentary's being made. What happened here in 1993 to the world was shocking. I lived in Fayetteville, North Carolina, home of Fort Bragg. You might remember for years there was denial that the Delta Force had been on the property on the day of the initial raid, February 28th, or had anything to do with it. The FBI came to visit me in Smithfield, Texas in 2010 because I had been saying online that the mock-up of Mount Carmel, which was built just 90 miles from here in Killeen and trained on by the ATF, was in fact not built at Fort Hood. It was built at Camp McCall, located on Fort Bragg, North Carolina, where the Delta Force trained on it privately. After training on it privately, they took the training tactics that they came up with. They appointed one of their own members to come out here to Texas, to Killeen, to Fort Hood. They disassembled the mock-up, shipped it out here, and it was reassembled at Fort Hood. And then the Delta Force oversaw the training by means of one of their members using the tactics they had come up with privately as a Delta team. And that member trained those tactics to the ATF. The only reason I didn't go to jail in 2010 when the FBI came to my house is because while that is not general public knowledge to society as a whole in the community of Fayetteville, North Carolina, it is public knowledge. It's has known. I knew this in 2002 at the last memorial I attended in this building. And I was afraid to speak it. I had known it for 5 years. And I was afraid to speak it for 5 years. There's a lot of question about what is a Branch Davidian. I'm not a Branch Davidian. I studied with Clive and other survivors for 10 years. The last studies I attended were in the home of Sheila Martin in September of 2012. My wife and I stay home. We keep Sabbath. We read our Bibles. That's the extent of our studies at this point, and has been since 2012. I've been out here to Mount Carmel under Charles Pace, visiting, studying, sharing ideas. What happened in 1993 to the world has become many things to many people. Some people, it's a political agenda. Everybody was outraged. You're absolutely right. What took place here should not have taken place here. And many people who proclaim no religious belief set whatsoever hold your same view. I hold your same view. Many patriot groups and other groups have waved this place as a banner for their own cause and their own agenda. But what drew the world's attention to this place here was another aspect. The many people I've encountered who have come as sympathizers, some of them have been staunchly political. Some of them have been political and religious. And some of them, their greater emphasis was to find out what was being taught. They were in search for the truth. They were after the religious message. And that's what brought everybody's attention to this place in 1993. It was the attention of God and His agenda. It was the spiritual agenda that brought all of those events into place in the first place. And there's a reason you're here today. No matter what your belief, what your level of belief, it was His agenda. Simeon has been on this property for years. Charles Pace has paid his bills. But Simeon worked like a dog in all those years, because I've drove up here many times and had conversations when his shirt was drenching with sweat, where he was the one mowing the property. The property that's so well manicured now was once manicured by Simeon for years. Ophelia, she was embracing Charles's message just a few years ago. Fully. At least apparently so. As I understand it, the bylaws of the Branch Davidian Church stated that members who reach elderly status, however, had a right to retire on this property, no matter what their beliefs, after that point. They had the right by the laws of the church. You don't have to worry about Simeon and Hondo removing your power from this property. And I'll come back to that in a second. I was here on this property 2 months ago, standing at the memorial, and God told me, don't come back. I walked in here 30 minutes late this morning because God told me, you got something to do. I didn't know exactly the full extent of it or why until I got here. And the first Branch Davidian survivor I met was your mother, Edna Doyle. Little museum was being run out of a building that used to be up here at the front of the property. I don't know if it still is. I didn't pay attention on the way in. I came here in 1999. When I arrived here, this structure was a foundation with the 2x4 walls built on this side and standing, and the walls on this side were built and laying, not yet erected. Benjamin's the name that I believed I received in a vision. I was invited shortly after by Edna Doyle to come and attend studies here. I remember my first encounter with her at that little building. Actually, it's 2 years later when I came back. I was invited to attend studies here in 2001. But in 1999, I was just wanting to know what happened. But more than that, I was wanting to know what was the truth that was being said. I remember 1993 footage on TV. I've never seen since, but I saw it once. It was one of these weekly Hollywood news shows. It wasn't all about news. It was about whatever was sensational at the time. I had been a former Baptist preacher, and I was watching intently to every newscast of what was going on out here. I told my friends, who at that time came to me for counsel on religious matters. I was a drug dealer. I'd left the Baptist church after divorce. I returned to what I knew. I've been clean and sober now for 13 years. I advocate a drug-free lifestyle. I don't condone those things, but at one time I was. And I'd been out of the church for a while, but I had been heavily moved by prophecy for a long time. And I told my friends, when I seen what happened here, I said, something's going on. This guy's either Christ or the Antichrist. And we'll know in time. And so when I came out here, I wanted to know the truth. I already knew the Delta Force were involved. I didn't dare speak it, but I knew it. And I asked Edna, hey, can I buy something from David? Do you have anything about his teachings? And she said, no, you can't. We don't sell the truth. David taught us that. You can have this. And you can have this. And she gave me some printed literature and a sermon taped by David, the 58-minute radio sermon that played here in the region of Texas but didn't play across the country like it was promised to. She said, if you feel like giving a donation, we'll accept donations to help out with what we do here. But I can't sell you anything that we consider to be the truth. Today, there are numerous people claiming to be Branch Davidians. Charles Branch Davidian. He was here under Ben Lois Roten. Clive was too. For a time, there was a website, the New Branch Davidian Church. It wasn't Branch Davidians. It was sympathizers, people who had been out here in the past but wanted to play Branch Davidian. And they played it for a while until there was no attention to be gained by it anymore, and now the site's defunct. Even amongst the survivors, you got different ideologies about what David taught. Clive has a viewpoint that doesn't hold in line with Livingstone. Livingstone has viewpoints that don't hold in line with Renus. Renus has viewpoints that don't hold in line with Clive or Livingstone. And these are the three prominent figures who rose in the wake of what happened with the religious message, or messages as they've become. He had a number of different church splits that have been going on in this group that predate David Koresh. But for the people who come investigating, who have no clue what a Branch Davidian was prior to February 28, 1993, most of them are thinking the students of David Koresh. Charles was not a student of David Koresh. He was a Branch Davidian. David Koresh was a Branch Davidian. Clive was a student of David Koresh. Simeon was not. I never met David Koresh in this life. My wife did. And so the world will look on some of this footage today and they'll go thinking, wow, look at all the fighting going on. But it's been going on. It's been going on well before 1993. And so you have to do your homework. And for those people who want to know the message of David Koresh, they look to Clive. And they look to Renos. They look to Livingstone. Livingstone produced a manuscript titled A Discussion on Branch Davidian Theology. I spent a year as his proofreader on that, proofreading that manuscript for him. And the ideologies about just what David alone taught is different from Clive to Renos and Renos to Livingstone and all the way around in a circle. But they all have a passion that what took place here in 93 was wrong. And they all have a passion that their differences will be resolved in time. But I'm not a Branch Davidian survivor. I wasn't in this property, in the building that was here prior, when all that went down. I wasn't a member of that church. If your ideas of Branch Davidian are students of David Koresh, then there have been no new members of the church since April 19, 1993, because there's been no one qualified to baptize. Branch Davidian today is a name, and it has lost its power because so many have taken that name unto themselves with varying ideologies. And you have to remember that. Ophelia, you did embrace Charles. So did Simeon. You lost your grip on him. I was here when that happened. The last time I was in this building, you told me that it was your job to pay for my sins and that you were going to damn me to hell if I didn't accept you. And I walked out that door as we argued. Well, there are people. Okay. The time before that, I confronted you when you had prophesied that Clive Doyle was going to die in that coming year, and you backtracked from it. But they heard it. You didn't just say it to me by my car. You said it from the pulpit in this building, in front of Simeon. You said it in front of Ophelia, and you said it in front of others no less than three times over a 6-week period. Clive Doyle will not see another memorial. He's going to die. You were referring, your followers were referring to you as a prophet, and you made that prophecy. And my last time at a service with you, I confronted you on it. I videotaped it. It's on YouTube under a video titled A Stone's Face. I videotaped that conversation as it was taking place in this building. It's been on YouTube since that time frame.
I said, and if he doesn't die to self, he will die.
But that's not what you originally said. And that's not, anyway, non point. I'm here to do what I came to do. You don't have to worry about Simeon. You don't have to worry about Simeon or Ophelia or anybody else removing the property from you. God's going to remove it from you, Charles. You've ruled this place with cruelty. No, he's going to rule this property. He's going to remove your grip on it. And your message will die with you, sir.
He does rule it now.
Okay, well, we'll see.
He allows things to happen.
I said what I came to say.
I understand. Thank you.
I don't know, do you? You going to watch?
First of all, I'd like to say, Charles, a long time, I was prepared to really not like you, but I was impressed by the improvements you made on the property, and I know it took a lot to do that. But I'm glad you're still alive.
Me too.
Amen.
I've wanted to live forever. People say, who'd want to live forever? I said, I'm not talking about in a wheelchair or you know, bedridden or a vegetable hooked up to a machine. I'm talking about living vibrantly and in good health. So far, I'm still here, even though I hurt.
At least you're not like that old penny that keeps showing up.
Well, I might be an old penny, but...
I did want to say that, you know, I worked with Ken on the film project back when the siege was going on, and consequently, I saw a lot of video footage from the first day and, you know, the initial assault and all of that, and I'm glad Rick's in here. The ninth commandment over there on the wall says, "Thou shalt not bear false witness." And I never met Steve before. Some of you people I've never seen before either. But the reality is, Rick, I was in Rockwall Municipal Court the other day for driving without a license, and they had a trial for me. And oddly enough, there's 34 minutes to the traffic stop with the cop there, and I immediately start telling him about being involved with the Waco investigation, which is a mass murder case. And there was all these points that I wanted to make to the jury, and the judge restricted me from putting the prosecutor on the stand because I really wanted to get down to the foundation, which in Texas we'd like to believe is the Alamo. Maybe there's something before that that really mattered to people, but you know, the truth is, we all have a responsibility, whether we're citizens of Texas, all capital letters, or citizens of the United States, all capital letters, or if we're just, quote, religious or political, we still have a duty and a responsibility to our neighbors to know the truth and to see that what is right is done for the children. And I've listened to a lot of tape. And I just want to say, in Texas, one of the greatest heroes this land has ever known is Wayne Martin. If you ever get a chance, students, listen to those 911 tapes. Listen to the negotiation tapes. And understand that this is supposed to be taking place in Texas where people, in good faith, care about their neighbors enough to know the truth. And we're all of us, guilty of one sin, one crime or another. We've all made mistakes. The question is, how do we go forward into the kingdom? You know, the first step out of the box has got to be in the right direction. You know, I use a lot of analogies when I tell people about what happened here at Waco. And you know, Texas is a football state, and I always say, well, you know, this what happened here is a lot like a football game getting started on a roughing the kicker penalty. It just doesn't happen, okay? If, in fact, those alleged public servants who are really agents of the economic terrorists who print the currency and own the media and run a crack house called Congress, if they showed up in good faith, they would have knocked on the door and said, excuse me, we have a warrant here alleging this, that, and the other, and then proper procedure would have been followed. But that's not what happened. And they don't ever want to talk about the helicopters and who died as a result of the gunshots from the helicopters. And these are the things that you students need to take real close examination of these facts, because the fact is those representatives from the bankrupt corporate legal fiction were not acting in good faith, and a whole lot of our neighbors died. And there are no statute of limitations on murder. And I'm really happy to see Clive alive and Sheila and Kimmy and even Ophelia. There's so many stories I'd like to tell you about, like when we were coming back in the van from the trial and we got pulled over in San Marcos. But time is pressing, and we have to recognize those who lost their lives and those that we'll see in the resurrection. Thank you, Clive.
Okay. Fire started shortly after 12, so it's been our custom, whether it's scriptural or whether it's worthy of being a custom, that's for you to decide. But we choose to remember the names of those that died around the time that it happened, the time of day that it happened. But before we get to April 19th, there were those that died on February 28th, 1993. Six of them were members of David's group. Four of them were members of the ATF group. It hasn't to this day been determined who killed who, under what circumstances, or what. There's talk of friendly fire, there's talk of, you know, we didn't fire a shot, they killed themselves, and all of this kind of accusations and innuendos that have been poured out over the years. People still come to me 22 years later and say, well, who fired the first shot? Who lit the fire? You see? It's never been settled to the point where everybody knows or believes alike. Like Mark was saying, if you consider yourself a student, you don't have to be still in school. If you consider yourself a student of history, a student of politics, or a student of current events or whatever, do some research. Don't be like the press that went to the morning briefings every day downtown while the siege was going on and just writing whatever was presented from the front. Don't believe everything I say without checking it out. Don't believe Janet Reno. Don't believe, you know, anything that's told you, whether it's the mainline press, whether it's the alternative media, or what. You know, there's been dozens and dozens, and I've got a good percentage of them, dozens and dozens of books written about what happened here. And all the ones I've read, some of them are very good, but they're not totally correct. Some of them are so far out, you wonder why they even allowed them to print them, you know. So, you need to study. You need to research. For yourselves. Don't listen to somebody else. Don't be, you know, stuck with whatever the last person that you heard said. But evaluate it. Study to show yourself approved. It says in the scriptures. On February 28th, there were five people that died as a result of the shootout in and around this building. This is not the whole building. This is the chapel, built on the same place that the original chapel was built. The building extended all the way over to my right, your left. So, you know, there were deaths and there were people wounded and so forth all over the building. The first one I knew of that was shot was not killed by the shot initially. That was Perry Jones. When I heard the shots at the front door and ran down the hall to find out, you know, check on what was going on, Perry was crawling up the hall screaming that he'd been shot at the front door when he went there with David Koresh to see who was coming. He told me David had been shot. Neither one of them died immediately. They were wounded. The first one that I found out about that was dead was a guy by the name of Winston Blake. He was from England, 28 years old. Winston was not shooting at the ATF. Winston was not out in the open, caught in the crossfire, accidentally or anything. But he was killed accidentally, theoretically. What the helicopters did was to shoot up our water supply at the back of the building, and Winston's room in the building up at the far end just happened to be behind those water tanks. So they shot through the water tanks, through the window, and shot him sitting on his bed. Peter Jent a young guy from Australia. He's the one that was inside the water tower. The water tower, our water supply had been damaged for years. And David had spent about $40,000 getting the water fixed. And it was being piped straight into the cafeteria area over near the swimming pool. That was the only water supply we had on the day of the raid. The water tower that the Davidians had built back in the 50s had been getting rusty from lack of use and so forth. And so Peter Gent was in there working on scraping and cleaning all the rust off preparatory to it being hooked back up to the well that had been fixed. He stuck his head out the top of the water tower as the helicopters came by, and he was shot. When we had our trial in San Antonio, three agents, if I remember correctly, three agents tried to claim that they shot him from out the front here with handguns. All three of them took credit for shooting the guy on top of the water tower. But Peter Gent's wounds were not from an angle coming from below, but were directly straight through him. In other words, the helicopters were level with the top of the tower. Peter Hipsman was shot blindly in what they called the dog run. From the chapel, there was a, you might say, a hallway that went all the way to the back of the building. And there was a window at the back that you could look out over the property. It was boarded up. There was no way you could see what was in that hallway. But Peter Gent was walking or running or whatever through the hallway, and the agents that had got into the gymnasium heard him, heard something in that walkway, and just sprayed it with bullets, and he got shot up there. Well, we'll do them all together when I get through this. Perry Jones, like I said, was shot at the front door. Perry Jones was David Koresh's father-in-law. I helped him back to a bed in the men's dormitory. And because so much was going on, the shooting was still going on, and people were running around going, what's happening, what's going on? I grabbed three guys that were in the hall, and I says, here, stay with Perry. Take care of him, comfort him, whatever, you know, you can do to kind of quiet him down and take care of his needs. Do that. Because I'd just been told about Winston Blake, and I went up to check on him. J. Dean Wendell was a mother of four little children. Some tell the story that she had been nursing the baby on, you know, in her room. She was laying on the bed and breastfeeding the baby. But Jadine Wendell was shot on the front of the building. For those of you that have seen the footage that the Channel 10 released, you know, the initial shooting in the front of the building out here, will recall that all these agents are hiding behind all the vehicles parked along outside the fence. You know, they're all shooting into the second floor, just emptying whole magazines of bullets into the second floor area. The front of the building, the center of the building, was where all the mothers that had small children were. All the guys were on the first floor, and they knew that because they'd been watching us for 2 months. They'd come over and visited us for 2 months, off and on. So they knew where the guys were, if they were figuring the guys were armed or whatever. But they're riddling the second floor where the women and children were. So we had, by the end of the day, even though Perry was only wounded when I initially took him back to the bed there, Perry ended up dying. Now, according to the court case, they said somebody executed him. I don't know that. I didn't witness that. I don't know whether they have any proof of that. But that's what the government tried to do in the trial, was to put the blame of just about everything that happened back on us. We committed suicide, we lit the fire, we executed people that were troublemakers or whatever. And I've said to people over the years, I'm just so glad that when I came out of the hole out here and was arrested, that by the time the fire was over and they found five more bodies back behind where I came out, not one of them was shot. Otherwise, they'd have said Clive Doyle did it and then jumped out the hole. They were looking for guinea pigs. Livingston Fagan was put on trial for shooting an agent way up here at the top end of the building, north end of the building, who was wounded and rolled into the ditch over there where they were building the storm shelter. The description of the person that supposedly shot the agent was a big, tall, black guy. Livingston was black. He wasn't tall. And he wasn't in that area. So they were looking for people to hang everything on. I'm the guy that lit the fire, according to the government spokesman. They didn't put me on trial for it, although my lawyer told me that's what they were going to blame on me. I said, why are they, why are they saying that? I said, well, your hands are burnt. I said, well, there's a lot of people that are burnt in there. Some of them are burnt all over. Maybe they were closer to the flames than I was. You know, how do they determine that I'm the lighter of the fire? So they dropped it during the trial. My lawyer said that they're not going to bring it up. They never charged me with it, but they were going to bring it up in the trial. They decided to drop it. And I said to them, well, now all of a sudden, why have they switched and changed their opinion or changed their what they were going to do? He says, they got no proof. I said, okay. But when I went to congressional hearings in Washington, D.C., one of the guys from Houston that was involved with the fire brigade and so forth, he point blank accused me in front of the congressional people on the stand, said Clive Doyle is the lighter of the fire. Kind of rattled me a little bit based on his theory, but I knew I hadn't done it. But it just kind of unnerved me at the time that it just pointed straight at me and accused me, you know. So we're going to ask Charles to ring the bell. Wait a minute, I got one more person. Like I said, Perry ended up dying later on that first day, not when he was immediately shot. All these other ones were shot dead. The other person that was shot on February 28th, member of our church, was not even here. He was working downtown along with Bob Kendrick and a guy from England. They were down at about 10 miles from here working on cars and so forth. When they heard about all this going on, they tried to come up 2491 over here, the road that leads out here, they had so many roadblocks they couldn't get through. So they went all the way around the back and came through the fields and ended up in a creek bed over here on the other property, the property behind this one. And The three of them were trying to get into the property later in the afternoon. Mike Schroeder was way out in front. His wife and kids were here. So he was in a hurry to get here, I guess. This young guy from England was kind of behind him, further back. And Bob Kendrick was lagging behind because he was an old guy with a heart condition. And so the next thing you know, Mike is gunned down in the creek bed. And I don't know whether it killed him by being shot down there, because there were 17 agents firing at him. I don't know which bullet actually killed him, but they didn't trust the initial bullets that brought him down, because I believe somebody went up to him after the fact, sometime later, and put two bullet holes in his head from behind his ear, execution style. So we have six of our people that died that first day. And we had four agents that died. Like I said, it's never really been established as to who shot who, or whether they got caught in their own crossfire or just what. But the agents that died were Conway LeBoux, Todd McKeon, Robert Williams, and Stephen Willis. So I'm going to ask Charles to ring the triangle 10 times, and then we'll go on to the rest of the list. The rest of these names died in the fire on April 19, 1993. Some end up being shot, apparently. Some burned in the fire. Some died of maybe, other reasons. Been all kinds of accusations, like I said, that we committed suicide, we shot each other, and so forth. But not all of them were shot. Some died from cyanide, which is one of the gases that make up that CS gas that they sprayed in here for hours. So with this reading, I'm going to ask Charles to strike the triangle after each name, because the list is kind of long, so we'll do it as we go. Catherine Andrade, 24. Chanel Andrade, 1 year old. Jennifer Andrade, 19. Excuse me. George Bennett, sometimes referred to as Ulrich. Susan Benter, 31. Mary Jean Borst, 49. Pablo Cohen, 38. Abadwalo Davies, we called him Dabo. He was 30. Sherry Doyle, 18. Beverly Elliott, 30. Yvette Fagan, 32. Livingston's wife. Doris Fagan, 51. That's Livingston's mother. Lisa Marie Farris, 24. Raymond Friesen, 76. Sandra Hardiel, 27. Raymond Free, excuse me, Zilla Henry, 55, Vanessa Henry, 19, Philip Henry, 22, Paulina Henry, 24, Stephen Henry, 26, Diana Henry, 28, Novelette Sinclair Hipsman, 36, Floyd Houtman, 61, David Koresh, 33, Rachel Howell, 24, Cyrus Howell, 8, Star Howell, 6, and Bobby Lane Koresh, 2, Jeffrey Little, 32, Nicole Gent Little, 24, Dalen Gent, 3, Pages Gent, 1, and an aborted fetus by Nicole came out during the fire. Livingston Malcolm, 26, Diane Martin, 41, she was British, she was no relation to Sheila. Douglas Wayne Martin, Sheila's husband, 42. Lisa Martin, 13. Sheila Martin, 15, Sheila Jr. Anita Martin, 18. And Wayne Martin, young Wayne, 20. Juliet Santoyo, which is Ophelia's daughter. Lost my place here. She was 30, sorry. Crystal Barrios, age 3. Isaiah, or Taco Barrios, 4. Joseph Martinez, 8. Abigail Martinez, 11. Audrey Martinez, 13. Those last five were all Juliet's children or grandchildren to Ophelia. John Mark McBean, 27. Bernadette Monbelly, 31. Rosemary Morrison, 29. Melissa Morrison, 6. Sonia Murray, 29. Teresa Nabrega, 48. James Riddle, 32. Rebecca Sapaya, 24. Steve Schneider, 43. Judy Schneider, 41. And Mina Schneider, 2. Clifford Sellers, 33. Scott Kujiro Sanobi, 35. Floricita Sanobi, 34. Gregory Summers, 28. Aisha Gaiafas Summers, 17. Startle Summers, 1. And another aborted fetus from Aisha. Go ahead. One more. Okay. Lorraine Sylvia, 40. Rachel Sylvia, 12. Hollywood Sylvia, 1. Michelle Jones Thibodeau, 18. Serenity Jones, 4. Chica Jones, 2. And Little One Jones, 2. Neil Vega, 38. Margarita Vega, 47. And Mark Wendell, 40. Since April 19, 1993, quite a number of the survivors have also passed on. We have Conception Acuna, who was Ophelia's mother. Victor Baritow. Jamie Castillo. Jamie was one of the federal prisoners that finally got out and died, I think, within 2 years of getting out of jail. Edna Doyle. Tilly Friesen. Bonnie Haldeman. Roy Haldeman. Victorine Hollingsworth. This next one is fairly recent. It's a new one on our list. Mary Bell Jones. She died last year, June 21. Woodrow Bob Kendrick. James Lauder. Jamie Martin. He was the son of Sheila. Catherine Madison. Trudy Meyer. And Gladys Ottman. So, like I said, you've got about 15 survivors that are now passed on. I'm getting to be one of the oldest ones left. Rita's mother is still alive. I talked to Rita the other day. When Ron and I took a trip last year, we went and visited Rita, and she took us over to visit her mother in some kind of nursing facility. And I was glad to be able to see her, because Rita was telling me that her mind was going and, you know, she wasn't very cognizant. But when we went there, she recognized me. So Rita told me on the phone the other day that she said that her mother's still alive, but she'd been in the hospital and is now in a full nursing care facility. She told me that Misty is still doing well. His son, Misty's son, is now about 18, I think. At least he's learning to drive, going for his driver's license. A lot of the children that came out during the siege were negotiated out. You know, some of them were very, very little. Some of them, like Mark Jones and Kevin and that, they were a little older, they were teenagers. But even these little ones are now in their 20s. I don't have a complete list of all of our friends that have died, but I'd just like to mention just a few, and that's Ron Engelman, Jack Howell, Bobby Howe, Michael McNulty, and Gordon Novell. If you didn't recognize the Bobby Howe, that was David's real father. What's that? I did the ones that were killed. We did that. We did 10 Marines. So I encourage that. That's the end of our program here right now. You've heard a lot of things that maybe were unsettling or whatever, but I invite you to mingle and talk with each other, you know, introduce yourself if you don't know each other. We will be heading to the restaurant. How's the time?
12:30.
12:30. So we got a little time before we go to the restaurant because we don't have to be there till 2, but I suggest we leave here no later than 1:30. And some people may have to leave. They've got other appointments to go to. And there's some people that were wanting to be here that aren't coming in till this afternoon, so they're going to meet us at the restaurant anyway. Marlene from South Carolina and maybe some others that didn't get here in time. So that's it for now. We hope to see you all at the Ace restaurant. If you don't know where it is, it's on the corner of Franklin Avenue and Valley Mills, and used to be the old
Ryan's
and A1. It's gone through a few changes. Like I said, if there's anybody that wants to go to the museum, I was hoping the guy from the museum would be here. I invited him. He said he'd come, but he apparently hasn't shown. So we'll have to give him a call to let him know when, if and when we're bringing a group over there after lunch. Okay? Thank you.